Now we want to welcome to the show one new guest and one loyal, familiar, old friend who's been with us before that many times we've done the show. Tanya Leotsakos from Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, and Iris Barron. She is an instructor in the Department of English here at the University of Illinois. And Tanya will be with us throughout the morning. We have her tied to the chair. She's not going anywhere. Iris will be here for the first hour, and then in the second hour, Kelly Strom will be with us. She's collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. And they will have some books to share with us, and people who are listening want to do that too. That's great. If you want to call in to the show, same numbers as always, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having
me. Welcome to Iris. I'm really pleased that you could be with us on the show.
I'm pleased to be here on the show as well.
All right. Well, since Tanya has been through this exercise before, I'll ask her to go first.
I have a request.
Oh, yes?
I have this book that I just can't stop talking about and can't stop thinking about.
Yes.
And it's a children's book. It's like maybe third, fourth grade reading level, but is wonderful for to be read aloud to kids younger than that, certainly. And I love it so much and had such a hard time deciding which passages to read from it. And I have marked some, but now that I'm here, I feel like I'd like to read just the first chapter, and then maybe if we have time...
She's looking at me so plaintively.
I would love to read more, just in between, maybe intermittently, because it's such a cool story. It's called The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane, and it's by Kate DiCamillo. And if you have children and that name sounds familiar to you, it's because she wrote Because of Winn-Dixie, which is a really, really good book. This one is illustrated, really sparsely illustrated, but it's what, if I may be so bold, I think it's what the Velveteen Rabbit wishes it was. I think it's what the Velveteen Rabbit really should have been. And so I just want to introduce you to Mr. Edward Tulane.
All right.
So I'm going to read the beginning here. Once in a house on Egypt Street, there lived a rabbit who was made almost entirely of china. He had china arms and china legs, china paws and a china head, a china torso, and a china nose. His arms and legs were jointed and joined by wire so that his china elbows and china knees could be bent, giving him much freedom of movement. His ears were made of real rabbit fur, and beneath the fur there were strong, bendable wires, which allowed the ears to be arranged into poses that reflected the rabbit's mood, jaunty, tired, full of ennui. His tail, too, was made of real rabbit fur, and was fluffy and soft and well-shaped. The rabbit's name was Edward Tulane, and he was tall. He measured almost 3 feet from the tip of his ears to the tip of his feet. His eyes were painted a penetrating and intelligent blue. In all, Edward Tulane felt himself to be an exceptional specimen. Only his whiskers gave him pause. They were long and elegant, as they should be, but they were of uncertain origin. Edward felt quite strongly that they were not the whiskers of a real rabbit. Whom the whiskers had belonged to initially, what unsavory animal, was a question that Edward could not bear to consider for too long. And so he did not. He preferred, as a rule, not to think unpleasant thoughts. Edward's mistress was a 10-year-old dark-haired girl named Abilene Tulane, who thought almost as highly of Edward as Edward thought of himself. Each morning after she dressed herself for school, Abilene dressed Edward. The China Rabbit was in possession of an extraordinary wardrobe composed of handmade silk suits, custom shoes fashioned from the finest leather and designed specifically for his rabbit feet, and a wide array of hats equipped with holes so that they could easily fit over Edward's large and expressive ears. Each pair of well-cut pants had a small pocket for Edward's gold pocket watch. Abilene wound this watch for him each morning. "Now, Edward," she said to him after she was done winding the watch, "when the big hand is on the 12 and the little hand is on the 3, I will come home to you." She placed Edward on a chair in the dining room and positioned the chair so that Edward was looking out the window and could see the path that led up to the Tulane front door. Abilene balanced the watch on his left leg. She kissed the tips of his ears, and then she left, and Edward spent the day staring out at Egypt Street, listening to the tick of his watch and waiting. Of all the seasons of the year, the rabbit most preferred winter, for the sun set early then, and the dining room windows became dark, and Edward could see his own reflection in the glass. And what a reflection it was! What an elegant figure he cut! Edward never ceased to be amazed at his own fineness. In the evening, Edward sat at the dining room table with the other members of the Tulane family, Abilene, her mother and father, and Abilene's grandmother, who was called Pellegrina. True, Edward's ears barely cleared the tabletop, and true also, he spent the duration of the meal staring straight ahead at nothing but the bright and blinding white of the tablecloth. But he was there, a rabbit at the table. Abilene's parents found it charming that Abilene considered Edward real, and that she sometimes requested that a phrase or story be repeated because Edward had not heard it. "Papa," Abilene would say, "I'm afraid that Edward didn't catch that last bit." Abilene's father would then turn in the direction of Edward's ears and speak slowly, repeating what he had just said for the benefit of the China Rabbit. Edward pretended, out of courtesy to Abilene, to listen. But in truth, he was not very interested in what people had to say. And also, he did not care for Abilene's parents and their condescending manner toward him. All adults, in fact, condescended to him. Only Abilene's grandmother spoke to him as Abilene did, as one equal to another. Pellegrina was very old. She had a large, sharp nose and bright black eyes that shone like dark stars. It was Pellegrina who was responsible for Edward's existence. It was she who had commissioned his making, she who had ordered his silk suits and his pocket watch, his jaunty hats and his bendable ears, his fine leather shoes and his jointed arms and legs, all from a master craftsman in her native France. It was Pellegrina who had given him as a gift to Abilene on her 7th birthday. And it was Pellegrina who came each night to tuck Abilene into her bed and Edward into his. "Will you tell us a story, Pellegrina?" Abilene asked her grandmother each night. "Not tonight, lady," said Pellegrina. "When?" asked Abilene. "What night?" "Soon," said Pellegrina. "Soon there will be a story." And then she turned off the light, and Edward and Abilene lay in the dark of the bedroom. "I love you, Edward," Abilene said each night after Pellegrina had left. She said those words and then she waited, almost as if she expected Edward to say something in return. Edward said nothing. He said nothing because, of course, he could not speak. He lay in his small bed next to Abilene's large one. He stared up at the ceiling and listened to the sound of her breath entering and leaving her body, knowing that soon she would be asleep. Because Edward's eyes were painted on and he could not close them, he was always awake. Sometimes, if Abilene put him into his bed on his side instead of his back, he could see through the cracks in the curtains and out into the dark night. On clear nights, the stars shone, and their pinprick light comforted Edward in a way that he could not quite understand. Often, he stared at the stars all night until the dark finally gave way to dawn. And so, the next night, when Pellegrina, the grandmother, tells the story, Edward's story actually begins. And as you can see, sort of a story about love and becoming real. It's really what the Velveteen Rabbit should have been, I think. It's so, so excellent. So I'd like to read more of it later if there's time.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see, we'll see.
We'll see, we'll
okay.
see.
Okay.
That last voice you heard belongs to Tanya Leotakis from Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy. And she's been in with us many times to do this new book show that we've been doing. And generally, it's been with Tanya and with Philip Graham, who is professor of English at University of Illinois. Well, Philip had to leave the country. So, while he's away in a secure and undisclosed location, we decided we wanted to continue to do the program, and particularly for this time when we're asking people to make contributions. So we said, well, okay, now we can do that, but we need to find some additional guests. So we went out there, you know, using all of our various important informed sources. And a recommendation came back for Iris Barron, who teaches in the Department of English at University of Illinois. And we said, well, would you come and be on the show? And she expressed some small hesitance, but she finally said yes.
Yes, I was asked to talk about new books. And while I read a fair number of new books, I've sort of limited my reading over the last couple of years actually to women's fiction, and specifically what's being titled now is Chick Lit, and I teach a class on it as well. And I got very interested in it. Actually, I was teaching a course a few years ago on the British feminist novel, and we started out with Jane Austen and ended up with Bridget Jones's Diary, which is a modern version of Jane Austen. And I started frequenting bookstores and noticing that knockoffs of Bridget Jones's Diary were popping up everywhere, and that they were heavily populating the bookstores, taking over some venues in the bookstores. And my daughter was working at Borders at the time, and I would go in there and pick her up. And Every time I would go in, I would see more and more like Malthus's concerns about human population. They were multiplying exponentially all over the place. And my interest was sort of piqued about why they were so popular and what some of the other Chick Lit novels really were reflecting on, how they got the name Chick Lit, and how they could be sort of introduced at the university on an academic venue. And so I started reading them, and I've probably read over 150 of them now, and I've just amassed a huge collection of them, and I got interested in how they were being marketed in the U.S. versus the U.K., Australia, Canada, and New Zealand as well, because we have a very different attitude about them over here. And so the class sort of grew out of that, and my Chick Lit collection just kept growing as well. So.
Well, are you okay with that term?
Yeah, what is the difference between how they're thought of here?
Okay, let me kind of start with that, actually. Bridget Jones's Diary came out in 96 in the U.K., and it was originally conceived of, actually, as part of a newspaper column that Helen Fielding, the author, was doing for The Independent. And it grew out of that, and she was asked to write a novel, and it was published initially by Penguin. And the British cover, I noticed, and I didn't notice this actually till I had taught it in my British feminist fiction class. I had a British student who came to class, and I noticed she had a different copy of it than I did. The covers are completely different than they are in the U.S. The U.S. covers, there's on the original one, a picture of a woman on the cover, and there's this blank notebook paper behind her. She has very wide open eyes and a very wide open, almost sexualized expression on her mouth, which I thought was kind of offensive, actually. And obviously the blank notebook paper sort of connected with the idea of the diary format of the novel. The British version of it is in monochromatic colors. It's all in browns and golds. And there's a photo of a profile of a woman, and her hair is up and she's holding a pen, and she has an extremely pensive look on her face. And
that's interesting.
On the back of the American cover, there were these blurbs about how hilarious it was and how, you know, deliciously insipid it was. Mm-hmm. And the Brits actually had first-rate authors commenting on the back of the cover. So it was a very different kind of an intellectual experience to peruse the British text rather than the American text. And as I was telling Martha when we were sitting out in the lobby, I taught Bridget Jones The Edge of Reason as well the first semester that I taught the class, and I still include it. But I had the American copy of it and the British copy, and I kept the British copy at home because I didn't want to drag two copies off to school, and it just became more convenient. I've done this in all my classes now. And I asked the kids to read the section where Bridget comes home from Thailand, and she is all psyched about the fact that she's going to be on the cover of the newspapers as this heroine who's gotten herself out of this Thai prison for these felonious drug trafficking charges. Always Bridget's bad luck. She goes to the kiosk in the morning and she finds out that this is the day that Princess Diana is killed in a car crash. And it's a poignant moment, but a comic moment in the novel as well, because, she's excised from the newspaper. And so her big chance of having her 15 minutes of fame is gone. But then there's this really poignant sort of extemporaneizing on Bridget's part about Princess Diana and about how women are treated as wives in British culture in general. And I asked my students to read, and they look at me as if I'm from Mars. And I think, okay, a couple of times I taught and I had tape stuck to various parts of my body or chalk all over. And I'm looking around and trying to figure out, okay, what's going on here? And finally I said to them, well, is that too much to read for you over the weekend? No one answers me. And I go home and I'm flipping through my books to find this passage, because I accidentally brought my American copy home. And after almost an hour, I finally realized it was completely excised from the American version.
It's just not there.
And the chapters were reorganized and reordered. And any mention of it in the American version was completely excised. And we had a phenomenal discussion about it and about Americans' attitude toward Chick Lit and how anything that dealt with any kind of, you know, intellectual seriousness would be excised from the text.
I have a caller that I want to bring in, but just now this makes me think that either if anybody who has read the American version of the book, they might find it interesting to go and see if they can find the British version, or maybe if you had dismissed this book, but you think that you might be the tiniest bit interested, maybe if you can, you should try and go and find the British edition of the
Amazon
book.
UK, I recommend.
Are there other, besides this one particular passages, are there other big, is there a big difference between the British edition and the one that was sold in the United States?
Not so much for Bridget Jones's diary. The weight measurements are in stones instead of in pounds, and there's some language that's changed. But the edge of reason, absolutely. There's just huge changes that they made in the text.
Well, I tell you, I have a caller here, and they've been waiting patiently, so I want to bring them in. And let's just do that. They're in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Did you say Chick? Smile when you say that. That is the title of a book that was a gift from my daughter-in-law, along with Chicks in Chainmail. It's a short story collection spoofs on people like Xena, the warrior princess, and so forth. And I had forgotten about it, sitting in a little corner here in the living room, and so I had to drag it out. It says on the back about Chicks in Chainmail, you need to take a sword-swinging Amazon a little more seriously. After all, you think it's a picnic wearing a cold brass brassiere, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's that sort of thing. And it's got both men and women authors. The reason I picked up the phone and dialed was that I ran into a book on a display at the Urbana Free Library on, I think they were called mini histories or micro histories, about histories about individual topics, and the one that I picked up is called The Map That Changed the World. It's about William Smith and the birth of modern geology. And that may not appeal to everybody, but what it turns out to be is how this one not aristocratic young man from Oxfordshire, who was the son of a blacksmith, figured out that the Bible was all wrong in terms of creation. And it was this confluence between British coal mining and canal building that gave him the opportunity to see and realize that the earth was layered and that the layers had different ages and that you could predict where other layers would be based on what you found. And this was the basis for our being able to find coal and oil and all sorts of things that people didn't know how to do, really, until Smith came along. And some other people contributed to this, but it also has to do with beginnings of understandings about what fossils were. When he was growing up, it mentions that milkmaids had something called pound stones that were conveniently right about a pound in weight and interestingly decorated, but nobody realized what they were. And what they were was fossils of sea urchins that happened to be just about the right weight and size and very copious on Oxfordshire where he was growing up. And, you know, this science has been going on for more than 200 years, and here we still have a huge number of people in the U.S. believing that creation is how, the biblical version of creation is how the world came about. It really gives you an eye-opening view of how he came to his conclusions and the whole history about that. And then the other one I wanted to mention is called Couldn't Keep It to Myself. There's another book called Can't Keep It to Myself, but Couldn't Keep It to Myself is edited by Wally Lamb. and who's a best-selling author.
I love Wally Lamb.
And he didn't actually write most of the book. He edited it. He got suckered into doing a writing workshop for women at the York Correctional Center in Connecticut. And initially it was just supposed to be something he was doing for the women's benefit. And then he showed, you know, after multiple drafts and versions and some of the women, some people not sticking with it and other people sticking with the program, and self-examination on the part of the women, he ended up with these short memoirs and showed them, a few of them, to an editor who was asking what he was up to, and they thought it should be published. And it really does give insights into how into the justice system and into individual lives. Very, very interesting. And it turns, we just had a discussion about it in our book group. It turns out he and the women are being sued now by the city, by the state of Connecticut, for having published the book.
When the essays are by the women, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. I think he contributes one essay. But yeah, he's the
incarcerated women. Yeah.
Right. Well, some of them have served their time and are now free, and they're not generally about what about the actual crime that landed them in prison. Most of it is about their childhoods or about, well, in one case, it's a woman who is a Rastafarian, and she does not, according to her religion, she's not supposed to wear pants, and it's about her battle to be respected, to allow her to respect her religious beliefs. So there's a variety of things, but we just thought it was really, really interesting. And it seems that a lot of the women had come to some better understanding of themselves through this, and some were, of the ones who were released, were beginning to find their way in the world and make better lives, until the Connecticut lawsuit, which seems to be a real bummer. Anyway, I would recommend those books for those reasons, and they're very, very different, and that's my contribution for the morning. Thanks very much.
I just would want to just in generally endorse Simon Winchester, who he's the author of the book that one of the books that the caller mentioned, The Map That Changed the World. He, in fact, I got a chance to meet him and talk with him. He was here, it must have been last year, I think he was here, yeah, last year, to talk about his most recent book that's about the Great California Earthquake. He also has written a book about the explosion of the volcano Krakatoa, and has a number of books that are all really interesting. And some of them, I think, if I'm remembering right, he actually does have a background in geology. And a lot of the books have to do with natural history and geology and things like that. So I would say if you're interested in that kind of thing, look for Simon Winchester, because he was a charming fellow and he's a good writer. This morning here on Focus 580, this is one of the shows that we have done, and we've been doing them for some time now, to introduce people to new books. And that doesn't necessarily mean new, absolutely new, but we think that it will be new to you. The idea is that we have guests who come on the show and they have read something recently that they think that this is really great and they want to suggest it. And I've gotten good recommendations this way. I know that people listening have too. Also, people who are listening can call in and recommend a book, as our last caller did. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And in this hour, our guests are Tanya Liasakis from Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, and Iris Barron. She's instructor in the Department of English at University of Illinois. We were just talking really kind of generally about chick lit. Is there a particular book that you might like to mention that you think maybe not only exemplifies that, but is an example of good writing?
Yeah,
as well?
Well, there's a few of them. I would really recommend Alison Pearson's novel, I Don't Know How She Does It, which is about Kate Reddy, who's a young mom, and she works in the bond business in the city in London, which is the financial district, and it's a brilliantly executed novel, and it deals with being a parent, a working parent, and it's written in a diary format like Bridget Jones's diary, and it's terribly funny as well. But I think it really combines and integrates, which I think the good chick lit does so well, some of the issues that women really have to deal with now as we have traversed into the 21st century and we've moved out of the home and out of the bedroom into the boardroom, and the kind of problems that women have dealing with these issues, dealing with romance, dealing with marriage, and dealing with maternity in a world that gives a lot of lip service to women's rights, but really pretty much still works on the same paradigm as we did in the 1950s. And a lot of the newer chick lit novels really focus on that issue as well. I have one here, actually, that came out last year. And this is part of a new movement in chick lit as well. It's ethnic chick lit. The original chick lit novels were all about white Anglo-Saxon Protestant women, and they all came out of the UK. And then it moved from England to the United States, and it's gone back and forth a few times. This one's called Imaginary Men by Anjali Banerjee, and it's about this character, Lena, and she's at her sister's wedding in India. One of the things that all chick lit novels focus on, they're very formulaic, is the need to find the perfect man and to get married. And in some of the novels, like this one, family and friends get themselves involved in them. But this, I think, also is beautifully written, and it's another knockoff of Pride and Prejudice as well. So I brought it to read a couple of pages,
sure.
And I'm going to go ahead and start. And she says, "You're rarely alone in India. I ran upstairs to the bedroom I share with Kali, my sister. There's no door, only a silk curtain hanging in an archway. But the illusion of privacy slows my heartbeat. I peel off my clothes and change into Victoria's Secret flannel pajamas. Relief. Any moment, a relative will stride in unannounced. But for now, I can breathe. How I miss solid doors with brass knobs and deadbolts. I've been here only 3 days. Jet lag turns my insides upside down. My digital clock reads 10 p.m., yet my stomach growls for breakfast. My hosts would be insulted if I asked for cereal right after the wedding feast, and now that I've lied, I couldn't even choke down my beloved Lucky Charms. My stomach has no room for anything but shame, and adult headache squeezes my temples. Besides, nobody eats cereal in India. We'll have parathas and dal in the morning with mango slices. India is a land of mushy food, rice, dal, curry. Everything is soft and yellow. A horn beeps and a man shouts in Hindi. Heavy air rife with pollution and smoke curls up beneath the high ceiling, and I untuck the mosquito net from the mattress and flop on the bed, a four-poster as old as the Taj Mahal. The mosquito net's white gauze lends a surreal fuzziness to the walls painted in jungle green, stained with watermarks from the humidity. A grayish house gecko, a lizard the size of a mouse, clings to the windowsill. Vertical pupils widen ominously. Geckos are harmless, I tell myself in a mantra. They won't slither under the sheets. They won't crawl over my face, and they won't bite my nose. They've shared Indian homes for centuries. They've watched mothers give birth, elders die. They flicked their tongues at foreigners like me, stumbling witless through an alien country. I was born here, but who remembers infancy? My parents whisked me off to America before I could say ma. Yet my soul connects to this strange, colorful, hot, smelly, magical country, even though I don't remember it. Do all Indians share a collective memory, culture imprinted on our DNA? Is that why I lied? Because in a tiny corner of my heart, I belong here? What a terrifying thought. Me, Lena Ray, poster child for independence. Settling in India with a husband, a family, impossible.
And tell us again the author and the title of the book.
Imaginary Men, and what happens is Lena's at her sister's wedding, and she's introduced to this guy she describes as being impossibly hideous, who's a potential husband. And she lies to her family and says that she's engaged. And they start all these ceremonies and celebrations for her. And it turns out that she's made up this guy, although as it so happens, Mr. Perfect shows up in her life. And it ends up pretty much the same way that Pride and Prejudice ends up. He's sort of an Indian Mr. Darcy. But it's beautifully written, and I think really illustrates the fact that chicklet doesn't have to be just seen as kind of some insignificant pop culture that you read when you have, you know, no time to read something serious or you just want to kill time. Some of the novels are just beautifully executed and written, and this is certainly one of them.
Well, the books that both of our guests that Iris and Tanya will mention here, we will have them on our website. In fact, I think Tanya's list is already there, and we promise that by the end of the show, the books that Iris has talked about will be there too. So if hopefully then people who have internet access won't try madly to be scrambling to write all these things down, as we mention them, you can go to the website and get them that way. I'll tell you what, we have another caller here, so why don't we get them? And this is someone, I believe, in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to recommend science fiction by Michael Flynn. Recently published novel of his that I read is called Iflheim.
How do you spell that? Like
E-I-F-E-L-H-E-I-M. It's a made-up word, I think, from a town in Germany the year. It's a name of a place where a town existed. And it's quite a cross-cultural, cross-species science fiction in which the insect people in a starship crash land in Germany in the medieval year of 1348, I appreciate the author's originality in that, and the fact that he uses phrases in German, French, and Latin, and expects the reader to know what some of them mean, but I don't speak any of those languages. it was a short novel, very entertaining, and I'm reading some of his novels published earlier. But there's one odd thing that I noticed about the way the book was put together. The actual text of the novel began on page 21, and I don't know why the publisher did that. It obviously wasn't page 21, and I've noticed in some other novels in the science fiction and fantasy genre that begin on page 13, 14 or something like that. Would you folks at Pages have any idea what's going on?
No. Is that a consistent thing? I mean, through all
I've,
have
I've
you
noticed
seen multiple
it in more
copies
recently of published science fiction and fantasy novels.
Is there a short preface in
yeah,
the book?
Yeah, if there's a preface or
So you're saying the text starts on page 21.
Instead of chapter 1, page 1, it was page 21 or 22 for that novel.
But chapter 1 starts on page 21, but is
there
a preface
before? There are blank pages, introductory pages, with the title.
Are there 21 blank pages before?
Nope. It was very odd.
So someone's bad at math, or this is done purposely?
Yeah,
it's a printing error.
They're
all like, have you seen multiple copies?
No, I have not. Just the one in the library.
Right. Okay.
And, I noticed on a different author, the text of the novel began on page, 13 or 14, but, the beginning of that novel on page, 21 was the most extreme example of this. And I wonder if it's some gimmick the publishers are using for reasons I cannot figure out.
Certainly not one I'm aware of.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check that out, though.
Yeah. So that's my 2 cents worth.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the recommendation.
You're
Others
welcome.
Are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. So then in book publishing, if there are any pages at all that are in there before the page one where the text starts, do they consider those pages for purposes of numbering?
It depends on the publisher.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they have Roman numerals. Yeah, it does depend on the publisher. And sometimes, the preface has Roman numerals rather than actual, the numbers. And then then chapter one starts with page one.
Okay.
But
I don't think I've come across anything where the first page wasn't page one.
There are printing errors all the time where, pages are missing or chunks of chapters are repeated, page numbers are repeated, but that's just a printer error.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was intentional or not.
Okay. Well, anyway, I appreciate the recommendation. Let me get Tanya to take a turn again.
Okay, I would like to recommend a novel by Lisa C. called Snowflower and the Secret Fan. It's a novel that takes place in 19th century China, about several different families there, and mostly focuses on the women and in 19th century China and this language that they had developed to communicate with one another called Nushu. It's like N-U-S-H-U. And it was just a different series of characters that men could not read. And it was kind of ambiguous, too, because like the word pair, for instance, P-A-I-R or P-E-A-R, you know, that there was only one character that meant that. And you just had to sort of understand from context what it meant. But it was a way for women to communicate with one another without, you know, the sort of oppression of men being able to read what they... And men somehow had no interest in this either. I think they sort of just thought it was something between women and they were never fearful of it or anything like that. But as we know, in 19th century China, there was a lot of foot binding going on. And it was pretty horrific. And I'd like to read a passage about that. Mama and Aunt resumed their pre-binding activities, making more bandages. They fed us red bean dumplings to help soften our bones to the consistency of a dumpling and inspire us to achieve a size for our feet that would be no larger than a dumpling. In the days leading up to our binding, many women in our village came to visit us in the upstairs chamber. Elder sisters' sworn sisters wished us luck, brought us more sweets, and congratulated us on our official entry into womanhood. Sounds of celebration filled our room. Everyone was happy, singing, laughing, talking. Now I know there were many things no one said. No one said I could die. It wasn't until I moved to my husband's home that my mother-in-law told me that 1 out of 10 girls died from foot binding, not only in our country, but across the whole of China. Not only in our county, but across the whole of China. All I knew was that foot binding would make me more marriageable and therefore bring me closer to the greatest love and greatest joy in a woman's life, a son. To that end, my goal was to achieve a pair of perfectly bound feet with 7 distinct attributes. They should be small, narrow, straight, pointed, and arched, yet still fragrant and soft in texture. Of these requirements, length is most important. 7 centimeters, about the length of a thumb, is the ideal. Shape comes next. A perfect foot should be shaped like the bud of a lotus. It should be full and round at the heel, come to a point at the front, with all weight borne by the big toe alone. This means that the toes and arch of the foot must be broken and bent under to meet the heel. Finally, the cleft formed by the forefoot and heel should be deep enough to hide a large cash piece of perpendicularly within its folds. If I could attain all that, happiness would be my reward. On the morning of the 24th day of the 8th lunar month, we offered the tiny-footed maiden glutinous rice balls, while our mothers placed the miniature shoes they had made before a small statue of Guanyin. After this, Mama and Aunt gathered together alum, astringent, scissors, special nail clippers, needles, and thread. They pulled out the long bandages they had made. Each was 5 centimeters wide, 3 meters long, and lightly starched. Then all the women in the household came upstairs. Elder sister arrived last with a bucket of boiled water in which mulberry root, ground almonds, urine, herbs, and roots steeped. As the eldest, I went first, and I was determined to show how brave I could be. Mama washed my feet and rubbed them with alum to contract the tissues and limit the inevitable secretions of blood and pus. She cut my toenails as short as possible. During this time, my bandages were soaked so that when they dried on my skin, they would tighten even more. Next, Mama took one end of a bandage, placed it on my instep, and then pulled it over my 4 smallest toes to begin the process of rolling them underneath my foot. From here, she wrapped the bandage back around my heel. Another loop around the ankle helped to secure and stabilize the first 2 loops. The idea was to get my toes and heel to meet, creating the cleft, but leaving my big toe to walk on. Mama repeated these steps until the entire bandage was used. Aunt and grandmother looked over her shoulder the entire time, making sure no wrinkles saw their way into those loops. Finally, Mama sewed the end tightly shut so the bindings would not loosen and I would not be able to work my foot free. She repeated the process on my other foot. Then Aunt started on Beautiful Moon. During the binding, Third Sister said she wanted a drink of water and went downstairs. Once Beautiful Moon's feet were done, Mama called for my sister, but she didn't answer. An hour before, I would have been told to go and find her, but for the next 2 years, I would not be allowed to walk down our stairs. Mama and Aunt searched the house and then went outside. I wanted to run to the lattice window and peek out, but already my feet ached as the pressure on my bones built and the tightness of the bindings blocked my blood circulation. I looked over at Beautiful Moon, and her face was as white as her name implied. Twin streams of tears ran down her cheeks. From outside, Mama's and Aunt's voices carried up to us as they called, "Third Sister! Third Sister!" Grandmother and Elder Sister moved to the lattice window and looked out. "Aye, Grandmother muttered. Elder Sister glanced back at us. "Mama and Aunt are in the neighbor's house. Can you hear Third Sister squealing?" Beautiful Moon and I shook our heads no. "Mama's dragging Third Sister down the alley," Elder Sister reported. Now we heard Third Sister yell, "No, I won't go. I won't do it." Mama scolded her loudly. "You're a worthless nothing. You're an embarrassment to our ancestors." These were ugly words, but not uncommon. They were heard almost every day in our village. Third Sister was pushed into the room, but as soon as she fell to the floor, she clambered to her feet, ran to a corner, and cowered there. "This will happen. You have no choice," Mama declared, as Third Sister's eyes darted frantically around the room, looking for a place to hide. She was trapped, and nothing could stop the inevitable. Mama and Aunt advanced on her. She made one final effort to scramble under their outstretched arms, but Elder Sister grabbed her. Third Sister was only 6 years old, but she struggled and fought as hard as she could. Elder Sister, Aunt, and Grandmother held her down, while Mama hurriedly applied the bandages. The whole while, Third Sister screamed. A few times, an arm broke free, only to be restricted again. For 1 second, Mama loosened her grip on Third Sister's foot, and soon that entire leg flailed, the long bandage twirling through the air like an acrobat's ribbon. Beautiful Moon and I were horrified. This was not the way someone in our family should act. But all we could do was sit and stare, because by now, growing daggers of pain were shooting from our feet up our legs. Finally, Mama finished the task. She threw Third Sister's wrapped foot to the floor, stood, looked down at her youngest daughter with disgust, and spat out a single word, "Worthless."
If anybody has ever heard of this practice, but wasn't really sure what it was about.
It gets so much worse. I mean, I didn't read the most horrific. I couldn't really bear to read the most horrific parts. But yeah, it's really horrific. And the mother, in fact, in the story is she uses a cane because she has no balance because her feet were bound improperly when she was a child. And if she doesn't have her cane, she sort of the description is so chilling. The daughter describes her as sort of flapping her arms about the room to as she like staggers across the room to keep her balance.
Yeah. We're coming to the point here. I'm really sorry. We're coming to the end of the first hour already, and we're going to have to say goodbye to Iris. And I'm sorry we haven't been able to talk enough. Perhaps on another day you will come back. And
that would be great. Actually, the text that you just read was really sort of reinforcing my views of the issue of the beauty myth in Chiclet and the way women are forced to starve themselves.
Yeah, that's why I picked it. I thought it would be a nice
And okay, so and this, Tanya, this book is again
Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Lisa C.
All right, we're almost to the point where we have to wrap up this hour, and I have a caller, and I really have to apologize to the caller because I think we're not going to be able to take you in this hour. Please forgive me. If you want to hold on, that's fine, or if you'd like to call back in the next hour, that would be fine too. And I promise we would really like to talk with you.